Well, I would like to start with saying thank you to the organizers for bringing all of us here and giving me the opportunity to speak about these results. It will be a mixture of discussion of some old results and new results. New results pertain to graphene and amine, and old results are for general high mobility conductors, and are very interesting, perhaps more interesting than my results, so we'll start with reviewing that. And explain the origin of interest in hydrodynamics and viscosity and charge transport and condensed matter, and then discuss concrete systems. So the collaborators on this work, my work, are Hao Yu Guo, student MIT, Andrei Shutov from Exeter, UK, and Grisha Falkovich at Weizmann Institute, Israel. Maybe let me start with very general remarks about hydrodynamics. Hydrodynamics is a very general framework to describe many physical systems, from gases and fluids to high energy systems and cold atom systems, and of course condensed matter systems. And the reason this is so, this framework is so popular and robust, is that it requires very little for it to work. It requires a system to exhibit local equilibrium and locally conserved quantities such as energy and momentum, or maybe others, spin density, or various other exotic hydrodynamic variables. But most often, it's energy and momentum, as in this picture. And then, as long as you have that, then all transport properties are governed by simple conservation laws that you can cast in the form of partial differential equations. And all you need to specify are some material constants, viscosity and thermal conductivity, and then you're done. You have a theory of everything that goes on. For example, in this picture, where everything, the waves and the air and sails and people on board are subject to hydrodynamical equations. One can argue also that hydrodynamics is probably one of the most important things that the humans, one of the most important theories, and also notion that humans learned and managed to put to good use, and without hydrodynamics being under control, Columbus wouldn't be able to sail to this country, and then we would be able to have this meeting. So it's really, really important, right? But then, if you think about conductors, charges in the conductors, then charges in the conductors and hydrodynamics being applicable there is a bit more questionable, because electrons in a solid exchange energy with lattice and also momentum with disorder. And phonons, because of that, energy conservation and momentum conservation are not, are not perfect, not as perfect as for fluids and gases, so one might think that hydrodynamics is not relevant, and in most cases, this suspicion is well founded. However, there are systems which are exceptional, and there are high mobility electron systems where disorder is essentially non-existent, or disorder scattering very slow, very weak, such as graphene two-dimensional electron systems and semiconductors and newly discovered system that Andy McKinsey will talk about. Then there are also strongly interacting systems where disorder is inevitably present, but interactions are so strong that collisions between carriers happen much faster than collisions with disorder, and so it's a good approximation to adopt to, you know, to think about collisions first and then scattering by disorder later. And so these are strongly interacting systems like non-Fermi liquids and high temperature superconductors and various other strange metals. And so the theory that I'm going to describe is developed, has been developed over a long time, mostly with the focus on the high mobility electron systems where interactions are not super strong, but disorder is very generous and is, you know, is weak enough to allow high dynamical picture to develop. So this will be the main focus. But I mean, for this audience, maybe I should mention the development on the case two, which is more recent than these high mobility systems, and started perhaps about 10 years ago or something with the work by Sajdev, who proposed that near the strongly interacting state and near the quantum critical point because of the low density of states and therefore poor screening and strong interactions will exhibit fast momentum conserving collisions, and those will lead to transport described by shear viscosity. And then a parallel development from high energy physics side was the work on viscosity connecting it to AGS, CFT, and other high energy concepts, and deriving universal bound, and you know, this is one of the many papers on that subject, and that led to interest in new collective phenomena that are due to viscous transport, and more on that later. Also, at the same time, when graphene came about, it was quickly realized that graphene provides an essentially ideal setting for this quantum critical behavior because it has a gapless Dirac spectrum for its carriers, and so there have been a lot of activity recently on trying to connect transport and graphene to to the hydrodynamical picture established earlier, and learn how to control it, how to measure viscosity, and there will be talks on that in this meeting in particular by Marker. Right. So few words on graphene because it will feature somewhat more prominently in my talk than other materials. So in graphene, if you think about the spectrum, it's a massless Dirac spectrum, and if you vary chemical potential, which people experimentalists can do by using gates and dope it, meaning make the Fermi level move away from the Dirac point, then carrier scattering rate drops, and in the limit when Fermi energy is much greater than temperature, it is described by the Landau Fermi liquid picture, which accounts for Pauli blocking in the field, fully filled Fermi states, and all the scattering is happening near the in the Fermi in the narrow layer near the Fermi level, and leads to a scattering rate which is proportional to the square of temperature, so it grows with temperature, also inversely proportional to the Fermi energy. So if you go away from Dirac point, the carrier scattering rate drops. And this formula, which is very, very robust and general, also tells us that if we go to the Dirac point, reduce the Fermi energy, then carrier scattering rate will go up, and it will continue to go up until the Fermi energy will become comparable to temperature, and then at this point, the carrier scattering rate will become as high as this. So it's highest when the Fermi level is exactly near the Dirac point. For various reasons, however, because of experimental feasibility and just conceptual simplicity. I'll focus on this case where the carrier scattering rate is not maximal, but still bigger than the disorder scattering rate. And the disorder scattering rate we can estimate from the mean free path values, which are measured experimentally, for example, by performing focusing experiments in magnetic field, where you launch particles from through one end of your conductor and then see them go over ballistic cyclic orbit all the way to the other end. And from the length of the mean free path, which can be as large as 10 or 20 microns in cleaner samples, one can infer that the scattering rate by disorder is very slow. And so we are, so in graphene, because disorder is so weak, we don't have to be exactly at the Dirac point. We can be wherever, and we have about almost orders of magnitude difference between carrier collision rates and disorder scattering rates. So if you dope away from Dirac point, maybe it will be one order of magnitude difference. But still we are well on the high dynamical side of things, right? And so graphene, because of that, graphene is, you know, very easy material to implement this, right? Then the other. Maybe the other general remark in way of introduction: if you want to write down hydrodynamical equations for charges, then you end up with doing something very similar to what people have been doing all along for ordinary fluids. Write down the Navier-Stokes equation and then replace pressure by electrostatic energy or electrostatic potential, and you are done. You have a complete picture of viscous charge flow. The value for viscosity that needs to be derived by considering carrier collisions will be, for the numbers that were given on the previous page, the kinetic viscosity, which is the dynamic viscosity usually used, in particular, known to everybody because of the universal entropy bound. It will be a dynamic viscosity divided by carrier density, particle mass, and particle density, and the kinetic viscosity is a useful notion because it has the meaning of momentum diffusion. So what this equation describes is that if you apply a force to your system on the right-hand side, then this force imparts some momentum on the particles, and then these particles colliding to each other, they exchange momentum, and momentum overall being conserved will be essentially instantly forgotten by every particle. So momentum will be quickly passed along between particles and will diffuse over the system. It will become a collective variable that will have its independent existence of the particles. It will diffuse and will dissipate when particles reach the boundary, right? And so this diffusion is basically what this equation describes. You can think about, if you forget about nonlinear term, you can think about a linearized equation as a diffusion for particle momentum, and a dissipation happening on the boundary sets the boundary conditions. And then in hydrodynamics, the important parameter to consider is Reynolds number, which is the ratio of velocity to viscosity. Sorry, they look so similar in that font, times the characteristic length scale, and the Reynolds number, if it's low, the corresponds to nonlinearity not being important, leads to laminar flows, and if it's high, leads to turbulent flows, and in between you get something like that, pre-turbulent flow. And in electron systems, for a variety of reasons, high Reynolds numbers are not as easy to reach as in fluid dynamics. Part of the reason is that this number, viscosity is sort of highish if you compare, for example, to one of our favorite fluids, and then the length scales are not as large, not as cannot build airplane size electron system, at least now. Usually L is microns rather than hundreds of meters, and so that's another order of magnitude, five orders of magnitude, four of magnitude, yeah, so that's the reason Reynolds numbers are sort of low. So basically, yeah.
You don't mind me interrupting?
No, of course not.
No, so that V is your drift velocity.
That's right.
The Fermi velocity, right?
Yeah, it's a drift velocity, right. So if we're, I was just about to say that for me, the most important reason Reynolds number will be low will be that the drift velocity will be very small. I will be interested in linear response. You apply weak current and measure voltage and look at the linear response in the linear response regime of voltage to current, both being small, try to stay at low currents so that the voltage scales linearly with current, and then under these conditions, drift velocity is small, also proportional to current, and Reynolds number is small. But then of course there is a conceptual question: if you push it, if you apply high current, then drift velocity in graphene, according to various reports, can be as high as 30% of Dirac Fermi velocity. And so how high Reynolds numbers can we reach then, right? But we're not there yet. I mean, people are interested in this, but not anything that can discuss. Anyway, that's the end of general. How are we doing? Great. Okay. General interaction. Now there are various topics in condensed matter physics that actually found it very useful to formulate things in terms of viscosity and there are various different works that I think that we don't have time to review. I'll talk only about the one which is relevant to what I'm going to do, and that's the work from the 60s by the people who tried to connect Knudsen, the two regimes known in fluid mechanics, the Knudsen regime, when the gas flows in the pipe such that the mean free path, such the flow is fully ballistic, and then the mean free path is of order of the diameter of the pipe. And the Poiseuille regime, when carrier-carrier collision or atom collisions happen much faster than it takes atom to reach the other, to cross the pipe, and then in electron systems, the analog would be just what this says. There will be the analog of Knudsen regime, known as first introduced by Fuchs, and analog of Poiseuille regime, first introduced by Gourgi in mid 60s, and it was shown that some of the striking phenomena known in fluid mechanics directly generalized to electron systems. In particular, In fluid mechanics, when you cross from Knudsen regime to Poiseuille regime, by increasing, by pushing gas through a pipe and gradually increasing density, what you see is very striking. You see that the hydrodynamic pressure difference that it takes you to induce this flow behaves in a strange way. As you increase density, the pressure drops. And the explanation for that is, purely classical. It is due to the fact that when you go to higher pressure, your particle collision mean free path becomes shorter. And then if you think about what each particle is doing, you will see that rather than traveling ballistically across the pipe, it will be going over zigzag trajectory with one step being the collision mean free path. And collision mean free path becoming shorter means that the zigzag trajectory becoming more zigzag, and then it will take it longer to go from, let's say, this point in the middle to the wall where momentum relaxation occurs. And that's simply because diffusion time scales quadratically with distance and inversely with the step of Brownian motion. And, And what that means is that if you reduce the step of your Brownian motion or the mean free path, the momentum relaxation time will increase. And that means that the momentum will be relaxing slower. And momentum relaxing slower means that you need to apply less force to make it flow. So it's somewhat counterintuitive. You're making density higher, but as the result, pressure goes down. And the electric analog of that is known as Gourgi effect. It goes as follows. I mean, in metals, you don't have a knob to control carrier density because carrier density is set by charge neutrality. But what they proposed instead was based on the fact that this carrier-carrier collision rate that I already talked about, in terms of rate, not in terms of time, scales in inversely with temperature squared. So if you increase temperature, carrier collision rate will become faster. And so here, a proposal was, let's increase current and produce heating by current. If we heat up electron system by current, even if temperature is much smaller than the Fermi energy, this will be a very steep dependence for carrier collision rate, and we'll be able to vary it in a wide range, and we'll be able to cross from ballistic regime to Poisson to viscous regime simply by increasing current in the system. And the prediction is that the resistivity, which is dV/dVdI, will decrease. And so then, 20 years later, also 20 years ago, this was tested in ballistic wires by Lawrence Mollenkamp, and indeed they saw the behavior, which is very similar to what you see in gas flowing in the pipe when you cross from Knudsen to Poisson flow. You see a drop in resistance, right? And so that. That's very interesting, and please remember it because we're going to use it in the next page. But then here, one more example of a similar nature. Well, actually, before we get here, if you think a bit more and ask what are other than the Strache temperature dependence, are there any other manifestations of viscous flow? You can see immediately that. What you find here will be a strange scaling relation between resistivity and the width of your wire, because your momentum relaxation is governed by diffusion across the wire, and it scales the square of the width of the wire, and that means that the resistance, which usually scales linearly with length and inversely with the width, will have an additional width square factor. So the resistance will scale not as 1 over width in this case, but as 1 over width cube. One factor width just geometric, and W cube coming from diffusion time scale, right? And so that anomalous scaling has not been seen until recently, until this work from published half a year ago, that you will hear more about very soon, where they varied, they manufactured nanowires using ultra pure material with this composition, and resistivity, resistivity ridiculously small, and so that it scales with the width, the resistance scales with the width in a super resistivity scales with the width in a strange superlinear way in agreement with what I just described. All right, so any questions here?
Yeah. Is there a good reason that I think all of the examples you mentioned are two-dimensional?
No, so this is 3D. This is 3D. The two other examples, graphene and gallium arsenide, are 2D. But that's not I mean, there's nothing fundamental about it. It's just that 2D systems are more easy to make clean, also more easy to control. You can add gates and vary carrier density, and then in addition to temperature, you have other knobs. And so, you know, the reason graphene is so popular, well, there are many reasons. One good reason is that it has many knobs, many more knobs that allow you to control things. But that's a 3D example.
Could I comment? I mean, yes. I mean, as we've discussed, it's you always got to worry about dimension with a real crystal. So this is the resistive anisotropy is about a factor of 1,000. So it's many, many layers in parallel with a weak transport coupling between them. So, you know, the theory that we used to analyze it was a 2D theory.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
You don't like that?
No. I do. But. Yeah. Anyway, so let me maybe quickly tell you about what I've been doing here. I've been trying to think of there is a simple way to measure viscosity, and one approach that is familiar to all of us since, you know, days of Victorian science was to take a fluid and push it through an orifice, so an aperture, and measure hydrodynamic pressure. So rather than using a pipe, just use a, you know, point constriction between two reservoirs and measure viscosity on that, and measure hydrodynamic pressure for flow through that. And if we create an electron analog of that, imagine that we take a 2D graphene sheet, just for example, and carve a constriction out of it, so remove material from these black regions, then we'll get a system which, you know, if done carefully and the mean free path, and we're in the regime when the mean free path is much smaller than the width, then the resistance through the system will be dominated by viscous flow and by viscosity. And then in principle, we have a tool to measure resistance in a purely electric way. What do we expect to see? So first of all, based on this discussion of scaling, we expect that the conductance will show some anomalous scaling with the width of the system. It will, rather than the ordinary conductance, which scales proportional to the width, this one will scale quadratically with the width, and so that's one prediction. And one can actually, you know, derive. Do a calculation and compute the flow. The flow is shown over here. So these, you know, black lines are the flow lines drawn in using the same rules as in electrostatics when we draw electric field. They are field lines drawn with a density such that the density of field lines in a particular region is proportional to the flow velocity. So that means that the flow velocity is highest on this line and smallest over here, where you see no flow lines. Notice, and we'll come back to that later, that there is this interesting pattern that flow is mostly through the middle region and no flow through the side regions. That's understandable because there is a no slip boundary condition that the fluid must obey at the boundaries, and so the boundaries basically create stagnation regions where fluid is not flowing. There are some flow lines here, but very, very few. You have to, I mean, if you try to make it quantitative and count the field lines here, you find that about 95% of the flow is in this 45-degree sector. And the rest is in stagnation regions. So the fluid really flows such that it is avoiding boundaries and forms some kind of a directed flow or plume that goes through the constriction and then spreads out. right? And then to, I mean, we can actually do a little calculation and derive this formula. And if you think we have enough time, we can do that now. Well, maybe I'll just sketch it now because I already made some notes over here. So let me. It's halfway, so I'll do it carefully through the middle and then quickly at the end. So you have to solve what we discussed already. You have to solve the Stokes equation, and you are doing it for an incompressible flow because your carrier density is fixed, and so the convenient way to do it is to say that charge continuity, which leads to zero divergence of flow velocity, you can solve by introducing a stream function and writing velocity as a curl over stream function in this way, and then if you plug this into Stokes equation and take a curl, the curl will eliminate the gradient of your pressure, which I wrote in terms of electrostatic potential, you'll get a biharmonic equation. And solving biharmonic equation is a very easy exercise. It's well known that biharmonic equation has a general solution in terms of analytic functions, which can be written in this way. It's a real part of analytic function and another analytic function multiplied by z bar. So that's a general solution. And then just need to find the right combination of analytic functions to satisfy boundary conditions, and the boundary conditions are there are two boundary conditions. One says that the gradient of the stream function along the boundary must give the incoming current through the boundary, and the other boundary condition for the no slip situation just says that normal derivative of stream function normal to the boundary is zero. And if you take this and that and look for a solution of this form, let's say for a point like source, we take a half plane and inject current through a point, then you find that the stream function only depends on the angle, on this angle, if you draw isolines of the stream function, they will give the flow lines. So these are also the stream lines on my previous page were just constant psi lines. And if you do that, you will see that the flow is purely radial. Purely radial, and there is a clear directional effect. It's mostly flowing up and no flow to the side. And call it plume, right? Right. Now, if you use the same framework to calculate potential, then what you're going to find is an expression. You just need to take this and plug into Navier-Stokes equation. This gives gradient of potential, and then from the gradient restore the potential. Then what you're going to find is that there will be. So this is where the current is injected. Then there will be three regions, and one potential is positive, and the other two it's negative. And the dependence is going to be some constant beta times current times the real part of z minus 2. And then if you write it in terms of the angle, it will look like cosine 2 theta divided by r square with a minus sign. And beta is some constant which is proportional to viscosity divided by eta square, and I think there is a factor of 2 somewhere here. Yeah, something like that. Right. So what you see, what you see here is several things. You see that potential, even though you use positive, you apply positive potential in this point to inject current, potential is negative in half of the area of your plane, and so this negative potential is a very interesting signature of viscous flow, which actually has been measured recently, and I think we'll talk about it in a second, and there will be more discussion of it in this meeting. Also, as you can see, not only potential is negative, but it becoming more negative as you approach the point because of this divergence. So electric field near the edge, even though fluid is almost not flowing, there is a strong electric field pointing to the source rather than away from the source. So it looks very counterintuitive. And you can also restate it in terms of resistance and say that there is a negative resistance, i.e., if you measure potential at this point, then this potential will be equal to R times I, and R will be a non-local resistance that will be negative, right? So is there an easy way to understand why resistance is negative and why the potential behaves like that? Well, what you could do is just to say that resistance is up to some constants, it's inverse momentum relaxation time. Resistance is always related to some momentum relaxation time scale, and you can write this using your favorite theory of resistance. I mean, my favorite is Drudem model, and maybe in high energy physics there is a different approach. But whichever model you use, resistance will be inversely proportional to momentum relaxation time, and momentum relaxation time in the situation when momentum is diffusing is going to be square of distance divided by carrier velocity divided by the mean free path. And that if you plug this expression in this formula, you'll see that resistance is A proportional to the mean free path, and that's potential proportional to viscosity, and B inversely proportional to length squared. And so that explains this inverse square dependence. And if you work a bit more, you can also understand the minus sign. But that's basically why there is this anomalous scaling. All right. So how much time is there?
About
20
minutes now.
Good. All right. So we are maybe. Yeah, maybe go here. Right. So now, if we want to do this constriction geometry, then what we are going to do is so I want to derive this formula for you, right? So the easiest way to do it is to do the following. Rather than solving by harmonic equation in this funny geometry, which can be done by a conformal mapping, one can adopt an easy approach. One can use an electrostatic auxiliary electrostatic problem, and this goes on. This goes on as follows. I can write a relation, generalize this relation I wrote there for potential in the plane due to current flowing through this region. So I will think about this upper half plane the same way as there. And I got some current through the boundary, which is zero over here, and is non-zero value in the constriction. And I can write down the potential in the upper half plane in terms of this current. And there'll be some function, some linear relation between potential at a point x prime and potential at the point x and y and current at the point x prime of this line. And then this function is basically what we calculated. This function is this function responds to a point source. And then what I'm going to do is specialize to this line and ask what the potential on this line is doing. So, and I will take the upper approach to this line. Then the potential on this line will be given by a formula which I'll write down as follows. This will be x minus x prime plus I zero squared plus complex conjugate. Right, and so this is simply this 1 of r square dependence on cosine is equal to 1, and the minus sine and beta should be accounted for. Okay, and then it's the relation between potential and current, which we already derived. The only problem is that we don't know the current distribution. So what we should do is use this relation to set up an integral equation for current distribution. What we do know is that because this is a conductor, potential is going to be zero on this line. So we should use this not as a solution to our problem, but as a way to produce an integral equation by posing the requirement that phi vanishes in the constriction, right? And then if you do that, then you get an integral equation that, if you stare at it, it reminds you of many things that you saw when you were young. In particular, the electrostatic problem. Two-dimensional electrostatic problem, when you have a three-dimensional strip which extends infinitely in this direction, and then you apply uniform electric field to it, and you get field lines that sort of do this, and then if you take the strip spanning the same width as the constriction, think about electrostatic variables and these variables, you can see that there is a simple way to relate the two problems. You have to take this 3D, sorry, this is 3D electrostatic problem. Right, and then of course x variable, which is this way, would become identical to the x variable there. I will use capitals for 3D and lowercase for 2D. And then a less trivial relation is that charge density on the conductor maps onto derivative of current times beta over 2. And electric field x component in this problem maps onto potential that they found in this problem by taking the limit y going to plus zero, right? And then once this is established, and you can convince yourself that this is true by taking this integral and transforming it by parts, so that 1 over x squared is written as derivative of one of x, and then moving derivative on j, and then this becomes equivalent to Coulomb's law relation between potential and charge density, and then you see this relation between charge density and current. And then if you keep going, you can translate the potential that you know for electrostatic problem, for this electrostatic problem, from conformal mappings, potential x and y, which is a square root of w over 2 square minus zeta squared square root times some lambda, and lambda will relate to electric field, and electric field will relate to potential jump. So if you do that, and zeta is complex variable in the electrostatic problem, right? So you can translate this potential, by following this route back to viscous problem and derive this formula. So what's the point of doing all that? The point is that you find the coefficient. You could say up to the coefficient, you could say what power of viscosity is proportional to what power of width, based on this, on the discussion that we just had. But with the coefficient, you can actually look at the numbers. And numbers are actually interesting. You find that if you compare this resistance to resistance of ballistic constriction, when you have no carrier-carrier collisions and the particle is just moving freely, free fermion flow, this is what you get, a zero temperature, by the way, when there are no carrier-carrier collisions. Then you get, because of this scaling with width square, and because of a fairly small prefactor, you can easily make resistivity in the viscous regime smaller than resistivity in the ballistic regime, or viscous conductance higher than ballistic conductance. So then the prediction is that there will be this surprising effect that the conductance, when you go from ballistic regime that you get at zero temperature, when there is no scattering at all, no scattering by disorder, no scattering by other carriers, to the regime when there is scattering, carrier scattering, resistance will drop and will become lower than in the ballistic regime. And so that's a surprising behavior that you can see experimentally by varying temperature and observing this viscous to ballistic crossover. And the explanation is what we already discussed, that there is this slowing down of carrier relaxation if you make slowing down of momentum relaxation if you make carrier scattering faster, so these are the phenomena that you expect in this constriction, right? So this is and resistance decreases, temperature increases, right? Good. So this is interesting to discuss some more because ballistic conductance is sort of a benchmark situation that usually is perceived as the ultimate fidelity transport in a conductor, and it is described in a textbook. It is described in terms of this Landauer transport framework where everything expressed in terms of transmission and reflection coefficients obtained for quantum scattering matrix of that, in this case, the constriction. You have to solve for the scattering matrix, and then conductance will be written as E square over H times transmission coefficient for each channel, summed over all channels. And if you're in a situation that your constriction is very wide, then you have many channels which are open, and the number of open channels, open meaning that the transmission is close to one, the number of open channels you can estimate quasi-classically just by saying that it's the width of the constriction divided by half of the Fermi wavelength. Then you get this formula. Then this formula reduces to the formula to Sharing formula, which says that it's conductance in E square over H times this number of open channels, and that was derived by Sharvin approximately the same time as Gurji derived his effect, but you know, they never, surprisingly, they were never compared to each other. So you expect that in this geometry, as you increase temperature and go from zero temperature with this Webbistic transport is a good model. To higher temperature, conductance will go up, and also at the same time you will see the strange strange flow pattern that we already discussed with stagnation regions and directed flow through the middle. If you try to understand intuitively what's going on, then you realize that actually what you are dealing with is an interesting correlation effect that carriers, because they're sharing momentum with each other, they are able to flow more efficiently than when they do so individually. And the physics is as follows. Carriers, even though they are indistinguishable fermions, they take on different roles in this region and in that region. There are fast flowing carriers through the middle, and then there are slow flowing carriers, almost non-moving carriers in these buffer regions. And those carriers, their role is basically to prevent momentum of these fast flowing carriers to relax quickly enough. And so they, there is this division of labor, if you wish, among carriers that creates this cooperative flow, and together they are able, remarkably together they are able to produce higher, lower resistance and higher current than if they were non-interacting. Yeah, and like I already said, it can be realized in a single device. We were interested, when we came across this, this behavior, we were interested how general this is, and looked at several other examples. And one interesting example that you can also tackle with this approach, that I'm going to describe, is when you have point-like scatterers, they are at distances much larger than carrier mean free path. Then, if you solve the problem, no time to explain how this is done. Then you find the flow, which has the same qualitative behaviors here. You have flow lines that bunch bundle up and form streams that circumnavigate the scatterers, and then other carriers which are not moving provide buffer so that these carriers can flow more quickly. So in this case, we also find behavior that when you increase the carrier scattering rate, conductance goes up rather than going down. So temperature, counterintuitive situation if you think about temperature dependence. Right. So then, okay. So unfortunately, most interesting part, what I probably won't have time to talk about. But then, the most interesting part is to actually try to understand the crossover from ballistic regime to the viscous regime. Not just to treat two limits and compare the results, but map out the entire dependence. And we worked on that over the summer for the constriction, to do this, one needs to set up, to pick a good model. Clearly, you need to solve, quantum Boltzmann equation with carrier collisions and between carrier disorder collisions at the boundary, and this is all very complicated. You can simplify your job if you note that collision integral for carrier collisions, complicated as it is, has zero modes. Zero modes corresponding to momentum conservation and energy conservation, and you pick up the model for collision integral such that it has zero eigenvalues for zero modes, obviously, and then all other harmonics of your distribution function relax at the same rate, so-called tau approximation for collision integral, and if you do that, your the kernel of your collision operator is a three-dimensional subspace corresponding to zero modes, and you can use it to simplify the problem. You can take transport problem and project it on this three-dimensional zero-mode subspace in the space of harmonics of your distribution. And then if you do the same type of a 2D to 1D reduction as we did here when we talked about hydrodynamic problem, you can derive some one-dimensional problem, but for this transport equation, which is applicable everywhere in the crossover regime from ballistic to viscous. And what you get looks a lot like a Lippmann-Schwinger equation for quantum mechanical scattering problem with suitably defined Green's function, which is derived from transport and the kinetic equation projected on the zero-mode subspace. And then solving that, you can solve it for any collision rate and find the results. And the results are quite interesting. So in the highly viscous case, when your carrier collision rate is high, then you get potential distribution. This potential distribution in 2D, and you see the drop across the constriction boundary, and there is a gradual decrease of potential through the constriction, and so this behavior at high scattering rate agrees with this hydrodynamical behavior that we just described. You even see these the horns. These are the negative electric field regions that we discussed here, and then when you go to the weak scattering limit, you get the behavior which is, with no negative electric field, of course, and more like what you expect in the ballistic case. And in this way, you can connect both limits in this way. But then, of course, you want to see, how does conductance behave, and you start with just calculating numerically conductance for several different widths as a function of collision rates, of collision rate, and for several different widths, you get these curves, collision rate increasing, resistance drops, as you would expect. Think about collision rate as square of temperature, and then it becomes more intuitive. Question? Sorry, no questions. Can someone ask something just to break monotony?
Sorry, I can.
Yeah.
But just simply, what you're thinking there about the Fermi velocity of your collision rate,
right? So this is... Right, so this is W given in the units. Collision rate is encoded in the mean free path. So we're comparing collision rate with the width by multiplying by the Fermi velocity. And so everything is reduced to a length scale, right? Right, and then, the units here, too long to explain, ask me later. The more interesting thing is that if you now, you expect from this discussion that everything will scale by mean free path. And if I, the only dimensional parameter in this problem is the width of the constriction divided by the mean free path, and so you can ask what will happen if you plot this conductance in terms of scaled mean free path for each of these curves, divide mean free path by the width. Then you see that scaled data all collapse on one curve. So indeed, it scales very nicely, and there is one universal function that you compute in this way. And this function is of the ratio of the W divided by the mean free path. But then, the surprising thing is that if you now ask what the conductance is doing, for that you just need to plot 1 over resistance, then conductance behaves as a straight line, as a function of collision rate. Straight line that has an offset at zero collision rate, that has an offset corresponding to ballistic value. Right. So from this numerical analysis, you very clearly see that there must be some analytic solution to this problem because your conductance is simply equal to the ballistic conductance plus this hydrodynamical conductance that we derived, and that describes fully the behavior in the crossover region, right? So this is the guy that scales with the width, and this one scales with squared width, and numerically, they just need to be added, and it is very accurate, and it scales for all W's, and you know, we've done more work on that, and clearly something there. Now we don't know yet how to solve it analytically, but you know, we're looking into it. The integral equation is fairly complicated, but it's not of a type which is vaguely reminiscent of the equations that integral equations people solve in matrix models and then in other theories where you have to use analyticity combined with some other tricks to solve the integral equation. So probably we'll learn more on that. Right. So let me. When do I have to stop?
A couple of minutes.
Right. So there is, maybe I already said all that. So there is the surprising behavior which is due to division of labor between carriers, that they when they collide fast, some carriers can completely avoid scattering by disorder at the expense of other carriers sitting for a long time in the buffer region, and this way they can achieve higher conductance than individually. Higher conductance means low dissipation. So you can, in this highly viscous regime, counterintuitively have lower dissipation than in the ballistic regime. And I already talked about the sum rule. And experimentally we can probe this by varying temperature. Well, clearly we worked out just one example, and one can ask, how general this is, and what, how high G values we can get, and what are the limits on are there any fundamental limits here on dissipation? So there are interesting questions that one can pose. All right. So maybe if I have one more minute, maybe let me. Okay, so we already talked about this, luckily, and that. Maybe let me just mention one more thing. So we did this exercise that I talked about here for different boundary conditions and point source through the boundary, and what you find is rather interesting. You find that for different boundary conditions, you get totally different current flow patterns, but sometimes you get identical potential distributions. So, for example, for no slip boundary conditions here and no stress boundary conditions here, you have radial flow, but in this case, something is flowing in the stagnation region. In this case, it doesn't. Whereas potential distribution in the two cases is identical. So what this means is that in this viscous flow regime, we have a very non-trivial relation between currents and potentials, it's not as easy to understand as in the ohmic region, where we usually take for granted that electric field and current are locally proportional to each other. And so if you know what your electric field is doing, which is usually possible to infer experimentally by various electrostatic probes, etc., you automatically know current. Here it is not the case, and it's more interesting than that. And then also, as I said previously, there is a measurement of this negative voltage at the edge that was published last year in the geometry similar to what we discussed, where current is injected through one point and voltage is measured at some remote location. And you see that the voltage is indeed negative. And they can vary carrier density and see that it's negative in the wide range of carrier density. Also, what I absolutely won't have time to talk about is the crossover behavior for this problem. Maybe I can comment on it by pointing this figure. What you see is that this negative voltage becomes most negative when carrier density is smallest, and when you think about what it means. It corresponds to the situation when your carrier density increases and becomes becomes comparable to the distance to the voltage probe. So just before turning positive, so that's the theory. So just before turning positive, as it should be in the ballistic case, it becomes most negative. So this negative voltage that we derived here, if you think about it as a function of carrier density in the crossover regime, you will find that it changes from positive to negative when you cross from viscous to ballistic, and B, it will be most negative just before it will do so, right? And so we discussed all that, and yeah, I think we can. I mean, there are also fun things that are happening if you take two of these constrictions and put them in series, then you can driving current through one and then through the other, you can induce vortices in the system. But no time to discuss that. I think we can maybe stop here. Right, so non-local relation between current and voltage and sign change and crossover, right. What I didn't have time to discuss, and maybe I should mention it because there will be other talks, is that the behavior becomes even more interesting if you go to the point in graphene where transport is relativistic, which is near Dirac point. I try to stay away from the Dirac point. If you go to the Dirac point, then you get new behavior because you get new conservation laws, which are important. Besides momentum conservation laws, you have energy conservation laws, and they are coupled together, and you get interesting behavior due to energy flow assisted by momentum flow. You get convective heat transport, and you'll hear about that. I didn't want to talk about it because you'll hear about it in the next talk, basically by Casey, and as you will see, you know, things become even more interesting in this regime when you have more conservation laws that play out together. Thank you.
Okay, we have time perhaps for one or two quick questions.
I was a little confused by your analogy with this mixing versus, well, I can't say that name, flow in a pipe. Because I mean, your constriction is very thin, right? If you give it a finite thickness, you make it longer, does the same effect still happen? It seems like the stagnation part is short.
You mean the constriction is short?
It's short. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there's no quantitative relation. One has to do separate theory for constriction, but this anomalous scaling is the same origin, and the fact that as you increase temperature and make collision rate faster, momentum relaxation time becomes longer and resistivity drops. That's the same, and it plays out differently. And I agree that constriction is a totally different problem. Even the resistance has a different dimension, so you're much easier to compare to ballistic case than in this Knudsen-Poisson transition. But I agree that it's not.
You can interpolate between them by making it longer.
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, not easy to calculate. I think it's a good problem for an experiment. In experiment, you can carve out anything and then measure transport.
Yes, I was very interested in the crossover from ballistic to viscous regimes in cold gases. That happens all the time because at the center you're dense and viscous, you have a high scattering rate, but in the edges, because you're in the trap, you're in the ballistic regime. So if you look at flow, You have to consider both. If you don't, you get some funny infinities if you do a naive calculation.
There are no edges in AMO.
Say again?
In AMO, there are no edges. It's just the boundaries of the trap
are
invisible.
So usually we have these trapping potentials transversely, right? Where in the center you have a dense gas, and in the outskirts you have a dilute gas. So in the center you're viscous, and in the outskirts you have to think about ballistic.
Right. Right, right.
But everything flows.
No.
Because
of the edges density is low and because of that cross section is low. Right.
So you cross over within the sample in the center from viscous to the outskirts, which is ballistic, and it's very difficult for people to actually model what I showed in the talk.
Thank God we don't have to deal with this in electron systems.
You do. And I was wondering whether your formalism can be applied to all kinds of geometries. Or was that very specific to the instruction?
Perhaps. But this reminds me of, maybe let me just take one more minute and abuse my ability to control the computer. If you go back to this old work. So in this experiment, they use constriction in gallium arsenide, which is defined by Gates. And from all we know about gallium arsenide, the edges of that constriction are very smooth as your edges in your trap. So even though they fit it to this model where momentum relaxation happens at the boundary, I don't think this has any grounds. They might have done something closer to what you have in mind. Mm-hmm. And in their case, density is indeed, just like you described, density goes to zero near the edge, and you know, much closer, I think it's much closer to what you described than to what these people worked on and what you see in fluid mechanics. But I mean, no one dared to say that. Before this moment.
You just did.
Before this moment.
Right.
So I mean, in public, of course, people discuss it in private. But
it's recorded.
That's right. No, I am. Yeah. I've done so many crimes in my life. I don't care anymore.
Postpone discussion.
We have one more.
Okay, there were two more.
I just wanted to quickly ask about the values of the convergence that you calculate. What is the viscosity that you use to get the 4K ohm resistance? How far away you detune from the Dirac point in order to get
We use the Fermi liquid model for the mean free path, and that's where this comes from. So that's why it's T square. So if you plug in T, you'll see that it goes inversely with T square. That's the Fermi liquid behavior.
Good.
I mean, near the Dirac point, it will become even better, but we don't have a good theory for that. Ask Sajdev tomorrow.
I had a question about what happens in a magnetic field.
Yeah.
Right, because you know that this very well, the negative local resistance, right, becomes this just simple transverse magnetic focus of the resistance in that case.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was wondering whether you have an intuition of what viscosity is going to do on that, because. Something I've been thinking.
Well, I'm sure it becomes something, but.
Experimentally, you know very well, right?
Yeah.
Nothing special happens, unfortunately, so I was wondering whether there's magic cancellations around, because just you have the ordinary semi classical focusing feature, and the only thing that happens is that the amplitude oscillations.
I mean, these things, I mean, ballistic behavior and viscous behavior, they're not that distinct. If you do an experiment by blowing at your hand, right, you can feel it here, but you don't feel it here. That means that this, you know, clearly viscous thing that you produce by a jet, it has very focused directional effect. And then if you apply magnetic field, you cannot do it with the air, but you can curve it. So it could be something like that, or maybe something more interesting. Need to look into it.
All right. Let's thank you all again.